Welcome to Pan Pacific. I'm Darian Woods. This episode is on medical adventures. We've got kids on stimulants, car crashes, fevers, and babies who have stopped breathing. So first, here's Wayne Stevens, starting with a story of rescuing a family from a car crashed under live electricity wires.
Car hit a power pole, and we turned up at the scene, and I was a kid in the back seat, obviously got some injuries, and then I went around the other side of the car, and there were now three people there. And I thought, holy crap. And then there was a power pole sort of teetering above us. And I thought, oh, and the fireman said that power pole could fall at any moment. And it was obvious that one of the kids had, who was there on the ground, had broken a leg. And I thought, and the other one else had a sort of chest injury. So I thought, it was just sort of like, this is time critical danger here. So we just had to move people quick.
Wayne Stevens is a budget analyst in New Zealand's capital city of Wellington. From Monday to Friday, he tallies whether the government's spending will fit into its budget for the year. He's a senior analyst at the New Zealand Treasury. That's his day job. But on Fridays, Wayne finishes work just after 5, walks past the Wellington railway station to an ambulance depot. There he hangs up his suit, and he puts on work pants and a green high-vis jacket. He's just about to start a second shift, a 12-hour duty as a paramedic on the Wellington Free Ambulance. I asked Wayne about how he deals with the danger. When you've got power poles about to fall, how do you decide how to proceed, or whether to proceed at all?
To be honest, I didn't really think about it at the time. That woman would have perished by the time the fire brigade got there. So it was a bit tricky. You do what you have to do, and afterwards you think, oh God, I must put my brain back in my head.
I followed Wayne on one of his nightly shifts. I put on the green high-vis observer jacket and sat in the back seat of the ambulance as he and another paramedic drove around the Wellington region. That night was apparently a typical night. A typical night is not as adventurous as saving families from partially submerged cars or administering life-preserving CPR to a heart attack victim. We picked up an older man who had fallen from his walking frame onto the carpet. Wayne and the other paramedic hoisted the man up, and my job was to stand in front of the old man's socks to make sure he wouldn't slide forward as he was lifted. The man had drunk a couple of wines, which had made him dizzy with his medication. His wife said that it was the fourth time they'd called an ambulance in as many nights. Many of the calls can be frustrating, especially when following medical instructions or drinking a little less alcohol could have prevented the problem. Each call puts pressure on the system. So I asked Wayne about what made it worthwhile, and he told me about a sick baby he was looking after once.
The child had difficulty breathing, so they called the ambulance, quite a serious situation. We got in the back of the ambulance, and I was in the back treating the patient, and we're driving up to hospital, and the little baby stopped breathing on me. Cripes, that was just about had a heart attack myself.
Had you done resus on a baby before?
Nope, that was the first time I resussed a baby. Giving a bit of oxygen, bang us on the child, and just got the air into the lungs or something. The kid sort of perks up and starts breathing again. Awesome. It was like a perfect outcome. I'll never forget the mother, how she just thanked me when I got to hospital for what we did. And I thought, yep, it was one of those days you think, shit, this is really worth it.
For special people like this, people who put in a full week's work and then more, whether it's helping their family at home or volunteering like Wayne does, it's hard to imagine how it's done, so I asked him.
I'm quite fortunate in the fact that I'm good at power napper. If I'm not on a job and we're at the station for 5 or 10 minutes, I'm asleep. And I'll be asleep and there'll be people yakking all around me, all sorts of things going on, and I'm having a snooze. And they come and kick me in the bum and get me up and there's a job on. And I perk up and turn on pretty quickly. Generally sleep the morning, 4 hours or so. By the afternoon, by midday, I'm up and about, and I prioritise the rest of Saturday and Sunday for the kids. They're my top priority. Spend the time with them and doing things with them. And so, it is a challenge, but it does make you think about how you use your time and what your priorities are. And that is always going to be my family first, kids first.
That was Wayne Stevens, who works for the Wellington Free Ambulance. Story 2, what it's like to be hit by a car.
I don't think I'm actually actively clumsy, but I feel like I definitely attract clumsy situations towards my physical person.
Sarah Ganley is an Australian New Zealander who is living in Canada. So she's covering a decent proportion of the Pacific Rim. I asked her about what it's like being hit by a car, because it had happened to her so many times.
I'm a seasoned pro at this being hit by a car business.
For someone else who asks, what is it like to be hit by a car? How would you summarise it?
Like, I'm not someone who especially likes being touched. Then all of a sudden, like, this massive metal thing is upon you, touching your person. It's a very shocking and confronting thing, and you don't entirely know what's happening at the time.
So the main thing you seem to highlight is that it got in your personal space?
Yes. Yes, it did get in my personal space, which is awful. I don't like it.
Sarah spoke about the first time a car ploughed into her and how being far from home can make these adverse events that much lonelier.
It was the day that my nephew was born, and I was feeling very homesick because I was living in Toronto at the time and he was born in Townsville, Australia. And I was coming home and I was in a grump. I was getting off the streetcar and I just walked out and a smart car took me out. And by took me out, I mean I smacked the side of the car. It ran over my feet. My elbow smashed into the side of the car. And I just kind of put my hands on my hips and wandered very slowly across the road. And I just kind of put my hand up and I was like, I'm fine. I'm so fine. I'm totally fine. And I managed to somehow walk three steps. And then this woman came running off the streetcar behind me. In the meantime, basically all of Queen Street West had stopped and ground to a halt. This is one of the longest and busiest streets in Toronto. And this woman came flying off and she's like, oh my God, are you okay? I'm a nurse. I think you're going into shock. And I was like, nah, I'm fine. I'm so fine. And she's like, no, you're going into shock. And then I burst into tears on the street and she took me into a cafe. And then the driver comes out and she's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I didn't even see you there. And I was like, well, you should be fucking sorry. You just hit me. And then the nurse told me to calm down and be nice. And I was like, okay, okay. So we're like sitting in this Turkish cafe with all of these really old men just staring at us. I see the streetcar full of people at the windows staring at me. The cars couldn't move because then the police had arrived to take everyone's statements. So there was the streetcar that I was on. And then by the time I finished giving my statement, there were another four streetcars backed up behind it because the problem is they can't move around each other. So I had caused quite a significant traffic jam. And as it turns out, the young woman who'd been driving the car was her first time driving in Toronto, which is in and of itself a horrendous experience. And then she happened to hit somebody and she was a waitress doing deliveries for her restaurant and it was her boss's car, and if she was charged, she would have lost her job and her boss's insurance. So I was like, oh, it's actually not that big a deal, like, we won't do that. But a month before, I'd been biking down my street and had biked through a red light and got a $350 fine. So I'd told the police officer that maybe they should try and be a little bit more consistent with their charging people.
She went to the hospital to check if anything was wrong. And there was something wrong.
I had tread marks on my feet. And I also chipped a bone in my elbow. And the doctor was very rude and he just kept poking my elbow. And I cried. And he said, what's wrong? And I was like, you're poking me. It's very sore. Because I think there's a chipped bone in there. And then he said, he's sorry. But why was I crying so much? And then I said, I'm very homesick. Because I just really want my mum to come pick me up from the hospital. But she lives on the other side of the world. And then my mum called at 4 o'clock in the morning to be like, what the fuck, Sarah?
Well, that would be helpful to kind of at least shatter the illusion that home is going to be perfect, maybe.
Yeah. Well, it's because I also called my mother from the hospital and I was like, hey, not to worry, but I'm in hospital and I was hit by a car, but it's totally fine. Like, it's fine.
Do you have any antipathy towards cars now?
I mean, I'm definitely not afraid to give someone the finger if I feel like they're going to invade my personal space. I find that most drivers, you know, they don't want to go out of their way to hit you. In fact, they want to go out of their way to not hit you.
I noticed there's a campaign on the back of on billboards in the back of buses that try to highlight that cyclists are actually human beings. So they've got, for example, a middle-aged man with a t-shirt that says Dad.
I've seen those too. The one that's most applicable to me is a young woman with a bike very similar to mine that has auntie written across it. And as I said earlier, I am, in fact, an aunt. It's basically me.
That was Sarah Ganley. Story 3, you probably won't feel a thing. John Lehman grew up in the fourth safest city in America. It's a leafy suburban town called Thousand Oaks, California, just north of Los Angeles. He described the high school he went to.
I couldn't stand school in general. It just sucked. It just feels like a prison. Literally, some of the like junior high schools that I went to and literally looked like prisons. And, you know, like that's how you're treated as well. When I tell people about my experience in high school, people are like, that just sounds just like the movies, you know, like going out to recess to play football and all the boys lining up. And like, I would always get picked last and right. That sort of thing.
Yeah. And so the nerds, jocks, freaks.
Yeah, geeks. That's right. And the cheerleaders and the football players and like that whole thing. Yeah, totally.
So John wasn't quite fitting in. And as we tend to do with problems, it was medicated for.
Because I didn't really like doing all of these menial homework assignments, my teachers and my parents and stuff really quickly decided that I had ADD and decided to medicate me for that so that I would like be a good student and do my homework. I went to the doctor's office and he's like, yeah, you know, here's a 30 milligram prescription of Adderall. Like, you probably won't feel a thing. It's a low dose. So just let me know if, and I can just double it for you easy. And so I took the 30 milligrams the next day and like got to choir class at 7 a.m. and I was just zinging. Like all the kids in the class that I used to think were really annoying, I was like, ah, Justin's not that bad. He's a cool guy. And then I got to my math class at 8 a.m., which was like the most horrible, boring class ever. I used to just sit in there and draw pictures of myself in a prison. And all of a sudden I was like, yeah, I like math class. I'll do my homework. Yeah, this is great. Got really excited because I was like, yeah, I can finally fit in with the system. Like, I feel happy when I'm doing my homework. I feel happy to like just be fitting in with this thing. Only there were like a few weird side effects, like the fact that I found it incredibly hard to pee and I didn't want to eat anything and I had cotton mouth the entire day.
So you're like a strung out raver in a high school in some respects.
And then I talked to all these other kids, like, oh yeah, I'm on that too. I've been on it for 3 years. Yeah, I'm on 70 milligrams. It's like, whoa. Some people who are really smart, they just figure out how to game the system. But for me, I just couldn't handle it. I couldn't mold myself to fit the system, even just kind of as a pragmatic thing. I just couldn't do it. After about a week, I was just like, this is wrong. Like, there's a reason I wasn't doing my homework. Like, and so then I just stopped taking it, yeah.
John moved to New Zealand in 2007. He painted digital plants for the film Avatar while working for Weta Digital. 4 years later, he co-created open source collaboration software called Lumio.
Do you consider that you were ADHD at all? Was it just a misdiagnosis?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting. Like, so working on a team now on Lumio, we're a very close-knit team and we're all very aware of each other's eccentricities and we kind of form around to balance those out, you know? And definitely everybody knows that, like, I get distracted really easily. You know, just like that extreme focus on details, having trouble, like, kind of sensing the forest from the trees. And yeah, so it's kind of all interrelated into my just general quirkiness.
Yeah, and it makes you who you are, and I'm sure a lot of people love you for those quirky traits.
Yeah, yeah, I'm stoked about it. I mean, the main thing is, though, it can get in the way, like working on something and spending way too much time on something and not realizing, okay, now, John, you got to move on now. And so, like, it's been great on my team, like, because we all support each other, like we've got this steward system where each person has somebody else who's looking out for them in the organization. And I've been working with my steward to like come up with systems for like time management so I don't get lost in one particular thing. I feel like I am where I am because of my eccentricities, but I also have, it's also like a thing which holds me back in a lot of ways too. So I'm just learning how to get the most out of it and not let the stuff hold me back too much. Yeah.
To Wayne Stevens, Sarah Ganley, and John Lemon for the interviews. The music behind John's interview was him. You can find his music online. That's John, J-O-N, and Lemon with two M's. Just type it into Google or Spotify, and it should be there. If you want to listen to other podcasts from Oakland, California, what I highly recommend is The Eastern Shore. It's an interview podcast by a man named Brock Winstead. It hones in on Oakland and the surrounding area through interviews with artists, writers, and all-around interesting people from the city and the surrounding San Francisco Bay Area. I first learned about the Eastern Shore after reading Brock Winstead's History of Oakland and Slate. He's an urban planner by training, and so his insights into how the town has evolved are pretty extraordinary. And you can listen to the Eastern Shore on Mondays, 2 to 3pm Pacific Time, or through iTunes or Stitcher. From Oakland, California, I'm Darian Woods, and that was Pan Pacific.